Good morning. Just a couple of points before we get started. You might be just interested to know that the sole quote in my entire book that I quote someone else that does not come from Ayn Rand, which is the great majority, an immortal philosopher like Plato or Aristotle, or an arch villain, is from this book by Harry Binswanger, which I found the part that I have had a chance to read extremely illuminating on the whole topic of goal-directed action and the nature of living processes as against inanimate. It had really tremendously clarifying material in there that I couldn't get anywhere else. So if you're interested in that subject, it is technical, I strongly recommend it. I want now to make a prefatory remark to the people who have never asked a question yet in our sixth session. Now, if that's by preference, of course, you're thoroughly entitled to your preference. But if you feel you've been crowded out by aggressive hand wavers, or that I've somehow overlooked you, and some people have remarked to me that they just don't get a chance, I am going to try today to reserve some period near the end, and we've accomplished our purpose for today, exclusively for people who have never had a chance to ask a question. And I will, for you people, throw it open to the entire material from the beginning of the book to the end of chapter 3. So if you've had a question and you just never got around to it, all the more vocal people for once will give you a chance. Now, I realize that some of you are not asking simply because it doesn't prove anything against you. You're just too shy to, face a crowd like this and someone who's going to not necessarily agree with your question up here. So I can't do much about that, but what I suggest is if you're in that situation, take the time in the next hour or so to actually write out your question and then just read it. It's much easier to just read a short prepared question if you're nervous about speaking extemporaneously. Ideally, the way to learn philosophy is one-on-one. As soon as there's two, it's more complex because two different contexts, and the person keeps wondering, well, I don't want to ask a question that might not be of interest to the other. When you have hundreds, and of course you lose that. So it is a difficult situation, and you have to, be like Androcles and the lion and just jump in, and that is not easy for people to do with abstract material like this, but I'll give you the chance. Spend some time right now to write down this question, and I'll promise to try to be as accepting of any formulation as I can be. It's the most I can do, but at least you're all paying, should get some sort of equal rights here. Now, today is our second session on chapter 3 on concept formation. So there is no mini lecture. We've already done the overview, and we're now just working through it section by section. So let us pick up with the middle section on concepts of consciousness, which is where we stopped. And that is 135. Now, of all of the subdivisions in the entire book, this in a way is the least important from the point of view of the book as a whole. This is not a broad principle or overall aspect of objectivism. It is a chewing of the theory of concepts. Therefore, it really is like one type of, or two actually, types of examples of what we've already covered. Now, normally, I keep examples to a bare minimum, but in this case, I gave a whole section to concepts of consciousness. The main reason being, although Ayn Rand covered this in much greater detail in her book, a proper theory of concepts has to show that it applies to every kind of concept. If you had a concept that applied only to adjectives and not to nouns, or to psychological but not to physical states, or vice versa, then obviously your theory would be defective or deficient, would have to be altered so that it actually covers every possible kind of concept. And one of the great things about Ms. Rand's theory is that it applies not only to simple physical objects or color patches, etc., but to esoteric psychological states and products and methods and so on. And I felt that to indicate, therefore, the power of her theory and the unrestricted scope, it was necessary for an audience to grasp, at least since making the distinction between existence and consciousness so fundamental to objectivism, and it's not self-evident at all how it would apply to consciousness, the theory of concept formation. I should at least indicate that. That was my reason for including it, but of course, if you're familiar with her book, there is virtually nothing in this particular section that is not covered better and more fully in her chapter. The other reason that I had to put this in is I could not present concept formation without discussing, at least in passing, the fact that concepts exist in a hierarchy, that some are built on others, that there are higher level and lower level concepts. First level that you get directly from observation, and then a higher level built on those. And I did not want a whole section on that, because that is really relative to the total theory. That is a detail, and a very complex and technical detail, especially when you say how the principle of measurement omission applies. And Ayn Rand, again, has a whole chapter, and it was not my goal to take every chapter and give a little compressed summary. But on the other hand, I did not feel, since I'm going later in the next chapter and subsequently to build on the idea of the hierarchical nature of the concepts, I didn't feel I could just cavalierly evade or ignore this crucial fact about concepts, and therefore I settled on the idea of introducing concepts of consciousness via the fact that there are higher and first level concepts, and then saying concepts of consciousness come under higher level concepts, and now let's look at them. So I in effect took several chapters in the book, on Rand's book, and conflated them into one section. That was my motive for this section. Let me say a word. I said we weren't going to have a mini class, but I just want to cover one question on higher and first level concepts, or at least indicate to you the type of answer. A question that's constantly asked: is there any option with regard to what constitutes a first level concept? Now, we define a first level as what you get directly from observation, a concept which can be formed exclusively on the basis of perceptual data without requiring any previous concepts, as against a higher level concept is one that can only be formed on the basis of earlier concepts. And the classic, of course, the obvious examples of higher level concepts are things like marriage, justice, freedom, government, law, which you couldn't dream of getting those directly from observation. You'd need a whole series of material conceptualized before you could reach those. But the question is, therefore, on the lower, earlier levels, is there any option? And the way it's usually put, could anybody conceivably conceptualize furniture before table, chair, bed, etc., and then reach table, chair, and bed as simply subdivisions of the concept furniture, so that for him, furniture would be a first-level concept? This is a question that has interested a lot of people. It's discussed, let me say, extensively in the new appendix, but I'll just indicate to you and then the answer, and you can then check with other examples and a great lengthy discussion in this new appendix. Ayn Rand's answer was this: in a sense, there is an option, but not finally, not when you finally organize your knowledge logically. In other words, by stretching her imagination, she could imagine a circumstance, she said, in which someone could conceivably get a generalized impression of big, motionless things inside as against moving, noisy things outside, traffic, say, and so have a vague impression of furniture versus traffic, Now, it would naturally be extremely vague because he's just lumping everything that doesn't move around inside as against the stuff outside that moves around. So he couldn't do much with that concept. It would have to be a generalized vague impression. Thrown in to his category at that point would be a statue, if there was one inside, the rugs, the ashtrays, bric-a-brac, all kinds of things indiscriminately would be thrown in. And also outside, he wouldn't be discriminating between traffic and roller skaters and puppy dogs rolling down the hill, etc. So he would have just two very, very vague generalized categories. Now, she said it's conceivable that he could start that way. So he has sort of a rudimentary concept of furniture. But before it could become a real concept, he would have to demarcate and specify. And her point there is the only way he could actually demarcate it, and what preserves its truly higher level character, is only by going through table, chair, bed, etc., conceptualizing them and then saying, furniture, by furniture I mean table, chair, bed, couch, etc. And then he would be able to abstract the common denominator, give an abstract definition which would distinguish it from statues, rugs, etc. In other words, in order for him to take his first generalized impression and translate it into a strict concept, he has to first conceptualize its essential units. That is, and those are the primary concepts that you get from direct observation. Therefore, when he finally organized his knowledge, his first level, the thing that he, even though he came to it later, the thing that he would now reduce directly to perception would be chair, table, bed. And the higher level, that is logically, the thing that would require reduction to other concepts would be furniture. Now that applies also to all these examples. Couldn't you conceivably form animal or living thing first? In all those, on the early rungs, there is this alternative of a generalized impression which you then have to specify. But when you do organize it, the structure of concept formation logically is not affected. Now, she even went in the other direction. Somebody said to her, let's imagine now, wouldn't it be possible for someone to form living room table or dining room table first directly from observation? And then, say, dining room table and coffee table, etc. And then as a higher level abstraction, when they grasp what they all have in common and say, table. So table is now the higher level. And this, what we call subdivisions, are really the first level. Now, in the normal context, that is impossible. A child couldn't grasp types of tables until he grasped tables. He would not be able, it's an issue of two things, his ability to discriminate and the frequency with which he sees a certain distinction. And in any ordinary context, it would be literally impossible for a child to discriminate this type of table from that type of table, to make that fine a distinction before he grasps such a, you know, blatant distinction as between table and bed. It would be tantamount to a child not yet having grasped bird and starting conceptually by distinguishing red-breasted robin from, you know, migratory wren. And it would just be out of the question. He couldn't tell that final level of distinction until he reached, first got the gross things that hit you over the eye. But she said she could project a case where a child would start on one of those lower levels. And she said, imagine a child born and brought up in a furniture store. His entire life and universe was a furniture store. So that there were room after room after room of dining room tables. That was like the dining room kingdom. And then next to it, room after room after room of end tables and so on. And his whole life is constantly bombarded by these radically different shapes, and that's basically, he has a very impoverished world. But that basically hits him over the head hundreds of times, and that's the outstanding distinction in his world. Now, in that context, she said, I could definitely imagine that the child would start with that type of object, what we would call dining room table, and give it one name. And another type of object, what we would call end table, and give it another name. And within that framework, those would be first level concepts to it. But again, what would happen if you brought him out into the real world, out of the furniture store? At a certain point, he would come to see, well, you know, when he got the rest of our vocabulary, that there's millions of kinds of beds and kinds of couches and kinds of everything, and that all the things that he was taking as primaries are similarly related to table. And he would gradually start to use table the same way we did, and we would be able to communicate back and forth. I don't know that starting that way would have any ultimate repercussions on the logic of his development. He might always have more of an affinity to dining room tables than, I don't know, than we would think is normal. But in that way, there is an option, but you have to imagine pretty far out circumstances. Leaving aside this type of case, the logical structure of concepts, there is no alternative. We are given directly what's available to perception and what is within our ability to discriminate. And as long as it's within our power to judge without any conceptual knowledge, within our power to detect, and it's presented with tremendous frequency, because you can't do it just on a couple of examples. You have to be at the early stages bombarded repeatedly. Those are the concepts we get directly from experience. And then by different processes of integration or subdivision, we form wider and wider or narrower and narrower cases, and a whole conceptual vocabulary is built up. That's the only thing really I wanted to say. Ayn Rand covers this topic really excellently in a whole chapter, so I'll leave it to her. As far as now concepts of consciousness, I call them all higher level for what simple reason? Yes.
First.
You have to grasp and conceptualize some external object before you could start forming concepts of consciousness. You couldn't turn your focus in and start conceptualizing the processes, for instance, of thinking, before you did a lot of thinking about external objects. So all concepts of consciousness presuppose an extensive conceptual development. So they're all higher level. Even so, within concepts of consciousness, there's a hierarchy. For instance, you would have to conceptualize fear, anger, desire, etc., before you could grasp such a thing as emotion or feeling, which would be a broad integration of a whole bunch of different kinds of emotional experiences. Or you would have to grasp seeing, tasting, touching, etc., before you could grasp sense perception. So that even though the whole realm of concepts of consciousness is on a higher level, it still has a structure within itself. And once you're able to turn into introspect and start conceptualizing, certain data would be the first data that you get by direct introspective experience, and that would be like the equivalent in concepts of consciousness of direct perceptual first level concepts, and then you would either integrate or subdivide accordingly. Now, the conceptualization of consciousness is an untouched realm altogether. We have very inadequate vocabulary to describe consciousness, very little exact terms to know that we're talking about the same thing when we talk. And the example of that is you need 20 pages just to indicate what you mean by focus. of description and examples and contrasts and so on before you can take a primary act, because you can't literally point a finger at it. You've got to somehow describe it. And I think our language or our conceptual development is definitely not advanced in this one area. So it's a whole field waiting for some psychologist hyphen epistemologist who will take that data and bring order into it. The only thing I'm interested in this chapter is to indicate that the broad principles of concept formation apply to consciousness just as they do to existential concepts. And I use the example of a thought process, and the key to it is on page 140. That middle paragraph, remember I was saying the thinking about concept formation as against thinking about what you're going to wear tomorrow. The size of the first process is much greater. And Ayn Rand uses the word intensity to describe psychological processes. And the only point that is really worth pointing out from our point of view is we can describe thought, the process of thought, quantitatively. More or less, how many elements, how much you have to know, how high it is on the chain, how far removed from the perceptual level, all of that is a matter of degrees, of amount, of more or less. And therefore, we can do with thought, in principle, just what we did with length or with all the attributes of man. We can locate a given thought process on a continuum of more or less, what Ayn Rand calls a continuum of more, greater or less intensity. And thereby, we can relate any given thought process to any other by taking anyone as the unit and saying it's more or less. So we do exactly what we did with length, and that is the process of approximate or implicit measurement. We cannot say it's 6.9 times more intense to think about philosophy than to think about a new dress. But you can say in a generalized way and within the context of a certain mind, because it might be harder for me to think about a dress than about a given philosophic point I already know, but leaving aside specialized factors like that, you can locate thought processes and say one is much more or much less, and that's all you need to be able to reach this continuum that then produces commensurability, the ability to relate each to the same unit, and thereby we just omit the measurements, and what's left is the process. So it works exactly the same way, although that is just simply a tantalizing indication. And I put it in just simply to indicate the breadth of the theory. Now, is there any questions on the concepts of, yes, consciousness? Yeah. Can't hear you.
While you were talking about table, I thought for the first time really about even a simple first order concept like table, doesn't that already presuppose some concepts of consciousness in terms of child understanding human intent, because the table is apparently for human use?
Good question, but no. He says, doesn't the concept table, which is a first level concept, require concepts of consciousness? Because to have an adult understanding of the concept table, you need to say an object intended to hold other objects, and therefore you have to have the concept of intent or function or purpose, and that involves concepts of consciousness. If the child's grasp of table at the outset were in terms of, in any way, its use or its intent, you would be right, and then we would be in a continuous vicious circle, because how would you grasp intent apart from first grasping certain things you intend to do, like put something on a table? So this is exactly the kind of proof that Plato would give, that you can't form concepts from percepts, Because you can't get table until you have intent, and you can't get intent until you have table or the equivalent. Therefore, we must know them all from another life, see, or we have them all innately. But the answer is the child's first implicit definition of table is purely ostensive. He knows nothing about its purpose when he first grasps the term table. He does not have the adult grasp even implicitly. What he has in that first stage is what you get only from perception, and that is a certain type of shape as against other types of shape. Chair type shape, footstool type shape, bed type shape, couch type shape, etc. Now, young children grasp by direct perception this type of object simply from spatial configuration without having any idea what they're for. Not any. Only after, but nevertheless, they have a concept of table because they can distinguish tables from other things. They do it simply by the perceptual structure. Then what happens in the course of their development, they come to discover that the structure is associated with a certain type of use. We don't eat on the bed or sleep on the table, etc. And he comes to realize that a table has a certain structure for a certain reason. Then when he becomes an adult and wants to give a formal definition, that is built in to his final concept. But in terms of the actual development, you must never think that the first concepts a child forms, even though they really are concepts of that existent, are known to him in terms, all the terms that an adult will subsequently give to that concept. Nevertheless, this doesn't mean he doesn't have a concept of table. He really does. Because when we come right down to it, if I say to you, let's try to explain what we mean by table. And you tell me, well, it's an object intended to hold other objects. I say, well, what do you mean hold other objects? Like with a hand? No, not with a hand. You put other objects on it. I say, you mean like put them on the ground? I say, no, it has to be up in the air. I say, well, what do you mean up in the air? You tie it to the wall. He says, look, a table is that, see, right over there. That's, oh, I said, that's what a table is. You cannot, have an infinite definition in terms of definitions in terms of definitions. At some point, everybody has to be connected back to what you directly perceive, because all concepts are a way of organizing what you perceive. And if table is first level, you ultimately cannot make clear what you mean by table, even if you give the most wonderful definition, until you finally come and say it means that. You see, this is why, a person with no senses, if there was some way to stuff the content of a dictionary into his mind, and even a good dictionary, could somehow rattle off the definition of everything, and it would all be gibberish to him. It wouldn't mean anything. The ultimate meaning of table is that. Now, this doesn't mean there aren't purposes to have a definition, but the definition is in terms of other concepts, all of which presuppose that you started with concepts like table. I'm really glad you asked that, because does that answer you? That is exactly the way rationalism gets started. They always, I'm not accusing you of rationalism, but that's historically is exactly what they do. They work out an argument as to why it is impossible to learn X from experience. And yet we know X. So it must be supernatural, it must be innate, it must be revelation, it must be the special structure of our consciousness, it must be any weird thing you can imagine. And their argument from Plato on, and this is essential to Kant, is always that. We know X, but we couldn't have learned it from experience. And the thing to do there, well, sometimes we don't even know the X is wrong. But in most cases, the answer to all those arguments is you certainly darn well could, you can even put it stronger, learn it from experience if you define what it is you learn at each stage, you see. Well, that was a really good question. I didn't expect that. Yes? Yeah.
On page 139.
Yes.
Content is a measurable attribute, on and on. And the introduction to Ayn Rand made exactly the same comment.
Yeah, I took this from her. I probably should have put it in quotes. Yeah? No, it's to relate. The question is, what is the purpose of the parenthesis on page 139 in that third paragraph? Content is a measurable attribute, and it's the context is that there are two things to omit in forming a thought process, the degree of intensity and the content, because thought is thought no matter what you think about. Whenever you do a psychological process, whenever you conceptualize it, or a psychological product, you abstract away from the content. An idea is an idea, regardless whether it's an idea of this room or what you're going to do tomorrow, etc. And the same for a thinking process. So content is one of the elements you have to abstract from. Why do we put this parenthesis in? Simply because, to tie it back to the theory of measurement omission. Ayn Rand's theory was, whenever you omit something, whenever you perform an abstraction, an act of selective focus as the basis of an organization, what you are abstracting away from is measurements. And since content is one of the things that you abstract away from, she simply wanted to tie in, this comes under the category of measurement. In other words, looked at from the vantage point of psychological processes, all the differences between dogs and cats and people, etc., are differences in the measurement of material contents. And when we think of them as simply object of thought, we ignore all differences, whether it's big or small, red or green, hot or cold, you know, complicated or simple, etc. And from that point of view, she's simply tying back content as coming under the topic of measurement to be consistent, therefore, with the theory of abstraction as measurement omission. But it's so obvious here, it's not really, it's not a crucial point. It's more just to tie it in. The more important point is measurement in the sense of variation on a continuum, you see, because content doesn't vary on a continuum. You just obliterate it when you're forming the concept. But what gives you commensurability is the intensity axis, the ways in which the process actually varies in amount, you see. That's good. I like you to ask questions about parentheses, because if a parenthesis is there, my basic rule is a parenthesis is guilty until proven innocent. It should be omitted. If it's not important enough to have the dignity of a full statement, it shouldn't be there. Oh, there must be dozens and dozens of parentheses that finally I brought myself to cut out. But sometimes, you know, they get away from you. Anything else on concepts of consciousness? Yes, sir.
Concepts of inner states, such as I have a headache, I feel energetic, I feel dizzy. Or could it be proper to say that those are concepts of consciousness which are first level, in that he's not abstracting from anything other than direct experience?
No, because he says when a child forms concepts such as I feel energetic or I have a headache, would it be proper to say that as a first level concept, because he gets it directly from his experience? I tried to cover that earlier. He couldn't do that at the beginning before he conceptualized external existence. No child could possibly reach such a sophisticated thing as headache before he had head. And he couldn't have head before he had man, or, you know, table and chair, etc. That's already a tremendously advanced focus, because we take it for granted. But if you watch the development of children, they have, you know, they get to a certain stage where they can say head, eye, nose, and they delight in that. And that far precedes the ability to say, I feel energetic today, mommy, or I have a headache, I don't want to go to the circus. That is already very sophisticated. It's true that, as I said, once you reach introspective concepts, once you get to that level, then you have to start somewhere. And some things are given you by direct experience. And I think, for instance, pain is certainly a primary. There's no way to, or headache is like a subdivision of pain, because it's pain in the head. I don't think you can get that except by direct observation. Pain, for instance. Some of the others that I'm not entirely sure how you would define them. Energy is, takes in so much territory, I think I'll pass that, but you get the general answer to your question. All right, let's move on to definitions. We'll have an open forum at the end on everything, hopefully. Now, definitions are is, of course, a crucial philosophic topic. This is not a matter simply of chewing or explaining the universal applicability of the theory of concepts. This is the final step in concept formation, applicable to every concept except concepts denoting sensations. The actual experience, red, is ostensive. You can't. What do you mean by red? This. That's all you can do. And the same for axiomatic concepts. But all others are subject to definition. I'll just go through a few points. I give the reasons why a definition is necessary. It must be in terms of essentials. They should be in terms of genus and differentia on the bottom of, I think this is material that you would generally know, so I'm not going to lecture on. But just point out on the bottom of 144, I think that is a helpful statement, the bottom paragraph 144, a definition in terms of genus and differentia is like the logical x-ray of a concept. because it gives you in one statement, usually just two terms or two short phrases, the whole pedigree of the concept, where it came from, how it goes back to reality. It tells you what distinguishes these units from everything else and how you came to form this distinction, within what category, within what CCD or conceptual common denominator you were working. So if you were doing man, you were distinguishing him, saying, for dog, cat, and the definition retains both elements. He is the only one with this faculty, let us say reason on the adult level, and I reached it by distinguishing him from dogs, cats, etc. Therefore, his genus is animal. So it's like both a historical summary of the essence of what you had to do to get it from reality, and it's a logical x-ray in that it tells you, just by looking at it, this is what sets it apart from this. Now, on the top of 145, that first full paragraph is a point worth noting. Every feature of definitions goes back to and reflects the nature of concept formation. Definitions can't be discussed except by reference to concept formation, and all their characteristics are similar to the genus differentia point. That is, they all flow from the nature of concept formation. So the definition, by the time we get to this topic, it should be pretty obvious and clear. It's just applying now one further step to how do we consolidate our content, our concept. But all the features will apply. For instance, concept formation is contextual. Definitions are contextual. Concepts, we're going to say in the next chapter, are objective. Definitions are objective. Everything that's essentially true of a definition will just be a mirror, a reflection of concept formation. This is just the conclusion of the concept forming process. It must never be thought of, the issue of definitions, apart from concept formation. If you're ever stuck for a definition, which can happen to the best of people, the thing to do is try to go back to how was the concept in question formed, to distinguish what from what. And that will be a lead to get started, as opposed to just staring at the thing and trying to think, what do I mean by it? Now, it's not always easy, but that's what you have to remember. Now, on page 148, we see the reflection in definitions of what we said last time about about unit. Remember, we said units don't exist in reality. What exists are things, but units are things grasped by a certain human perspective. The combination of metaphysics and epistemology, or existence and consciousness. And we said that would be the permeate of the entire conceptual level. Well, here in this paragraph, you see it in regard to definitions. Definitions are determined by the facts of reality within the context of one's knowledge. Both are crucial, reality and our context, existence and consciousness. Now, this flows directly from the fact that a unit is existence from a certain perspective. Well, therefore, when we organize units and try to distinguish them, we must always keep in mind that same thing. It's a fact that we're focused on from our specifically human perspective. So in that sense, definitions are, quote, only human. In reality, there's no essences. There's just facts. But the essences are, perform some function in human conceptualization. But that is not arbitrary, because we are grasping reality and we have to do it in accordance with laws of reality. So again, it's existence and consciousness. And it's the same point as the point about units. That, of course, is going to be the whole subject of the next chapter. And this is where the name of objectivism came from, of course, from the topic of objectivity. Now, on the top of 149, I'm just flitting from point to point that I think might be worth a comment. We're stating that in terms of the differential, rationality names that, at the very top of 149, names that which most significantly sets man apart from other things. It names that which makes man man. Now, that is not, that formulation, of course, goes all the way back through the centuries, but that formulation has always been challenged by a certain type of nominalist or skeptic philosopher who would say, what do you mean, makes man man? Isn't everything about man make him what he was? If he didn't have lungs, he wouldn't be man. And therefore, having lungs makes him man, he would die. And I deliberately clung to this age-old formulation because the traditional philosophers are entirely right. But I went on with an IE to explain what objectivism means by that. It is not a metaphysical discrimination here. We're not saying rationality really counts and lungs are dispensable. Whether you have them or not doesn't make any difference. They're not that important. That would be absurd. But when you take it from the framework of epistemology, what do we need in order to retain the content of a concept, to keep it clear in our mind, related to its units, and distinguished from all other concepts? That's where, when we find a characteristic, if we can do this, which underlies and gives rise to the greatest number of the unit's other characteristics, we have been able to condense them all into one. And thereby, that is the thing that underlies and makes possible all those others, and therefore which carries them with it in your mind. Once you know rationality, if that's not a floating abstraction, you know thousands of distinctions that man has implicit in that. Whereas if all you know is that he has a thumb, or that he can darn socks, or whichever, and that's how you thought of him, the thing would be a blank, just one little floating attribute, and it would not serve to keep your concept alive in your mind and contrast it to all the others. So it makes man man, not metaphysically, but it makes the concept that concept. That is the thing on which our mind is going to hang all, or at least as most as we can, many as we can, of the other attributes, so that we can hold it all and keep it distinguished. Notice on 150, that little parenthesis, we always talk in the theory of definition about differentia, the fundamental distinguishing characteristic. But I just threw that in for the heck of it. You also need a fundamental integrating characteristic. And this is to answer people who say, why couldn't you define man as a rational solid? There are people who want to do that. S-O-L-I-D. A rational solid. Well, he is a rational solid, but with fluid inside. But that would obviously be unacceptable as an adult definition, nor could I even imagine a child's context that would lead to that. And here again, this is the issue of fundamentality. If you, all you think of is man as a solid who happens to be rational, you would be saying, in effect, you have no conceptual common denominator. You distinguish man from rivers. See, that the only common denominator is some state of matter. You put solid things against liquid things, and then you went right away from there to the rational solids versus presumably the irrational ones like rivers or like ice. Now, no one could form concepts that way, it's fantasy to begin with, nor would that explain anything about man, or very little. It would explain only what you already know about every other solid in the world, whereas animal actually names what you distinguish man from, dogs and cats and so on, and the genus is fundamental. Therefore, everything you know about animals is now carried along in your definition of man, and therefore you know the totality, a certain type of structure and blood supply and veins, whatever it is that's true of all animals. I'll leave that to biologists. So that on both the level of the differential and the genus, you have to try to get the term or the point that will carry the greatest amount of information, that will condense the greatest amount into one unit. And then when you put the two together, you carry both what's similar to other things and what's different from other things in just a couple of terms, like rational animal, or maybe a little longer than that. And the result is you are able to, I say that on the very bottom of 150. What a definition does is condense. That's its essential function. I told you that this issue of condensation is going to be central throughout objectivism. We mentioned it in passing in a very different way under the discussion of the sensation condenses a vast amount of external data. But now we're within the conceptual realm, and it is a true condensation because the definition presupposes and implies all of the attributes, but we couldn't hold them all as just an indiscriminate catalog. They would simply drop out of awareness. So what you have to do is process the units. You say, it's similar to so. Now the fundamental there is, it's an animal. It's different in this way, and what carries all that is rational. So you need three things, really, to grasp a proper definition. I put them near the bottom of that large first paragraph. You need to survey and analyze similarities. That gives you your genus. Similarities to other things. Differences, that gives you your differentia. And in both cases, causal relationships. What is the fundamental underlying? And the result will be a very brief statement that will condense the total of the thing. And then the next paragraph, I think, is cardinal here. That characteristic, by virtue of its method of selection, is an invaluable tool of integration. So it's useless to memorize a definition, even if it's a perfect definition. The whole thing about a definition is that you have to reach it by yourself analyzing the observed data. You have to process the information. You have to list your similarities and list your differences and work to untangle, wherever applicable, the fundamental. When you do that, everything is then carried, or virtually everything, in your definition. And thus, a complex sum, which would otherwise simply vanish from our minds, is reduced to a few simple elements. And we can easily, whenever we're in doubt, rattle it off and bring the whole reality of the units and everything we know about them back to us. On the other hand, if you pick a definition arbitrarily or you ignore fundamentals, you just, the example I give is you pick the thumb. You don't see that a thumb, anything of consequence hinges on it. You don't see how it leads to any particular consequences, but let's say it happens to be that man alone has a thumb. Or I think someone once defined man as being capable of giggling intelligently, because he has against laughing hyena. Now, there are these people. The animal who's always in heat. That's another one. Now, these, they go on forever. Now, whether it's true or false, all of those are entirely beside the point, even if they were absolutely unique. Suppose that man was the only being capable of sex 365 days a year. That does not discriminate him from the others in a significant way, because there are vast differences that are not connected to it in our knowledge. And therefore, the hundreds and hundreds and thousands of things that men do and think and are capable of that distinguish him from the other animals are simply ignored altogether. That's just like the example I use here is having the thumb. When you pick arbitrarily without reference to fundamentals, the evil of that is that you are picking a definition without processing the material, without trying to analyze similarities, differences, and causal relationships. And therefore, whatever you pick, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't carry with it the other features of the unit, so it doesn't serve its function. It becomes a floating abstraction. That is why a memorized definition does you no good, even if it's a perfect definition. You have to see yourself, not only that man is rational, but that that's what underlies so-and-so and so-and-so. And then it will work. So this is a very crucial thing. Never to pick an isolated characteristic just at random, because it defeats itself. You end up with a floating abstraction. And thus on 153, the evil of the idea that a concept is interchangeable with its definition. Man does not mean animality plus rationality, modern philosophers to the contrary notwithstanding. Man has innumerable characteristics. We pick certain ones to guide us in holding the concept, because in a certain context of knowledge, they condense the units better than any other. But that has nothing to do with the concept being exhausted by the definition. As you know, of course, we can change definitions with the same concept. And that simply means that in a certain context, later on, we find that other characteristics preserve this or perform this condensing function better than the earlier one. But if you equate a concept with its definition, that means you detach the concept from its units. You make it just a name for other names, a word for other words, and the result of that is, well, the way I describe it here is a brazen prescription for disintegration. And that is surely what it is. That's again, I try to avoid words like brazen, vicious, although I did call Rawls vicious in this book, in the next chapter, I think. Then wasn't it vicious or some word like that? I couldn't resist it. But once in a while, you know, it gets so bad that you just can't let it go without yelling out. And then the next paragraph in 153, the crucial point of objectivism as against the whole analytic synthetic dichotomy. A concept refers to and designates existence, including all their characteristics, whether definitional or not, whether known or not. And remember the issue of known or not. We took the example of forming table when you don't even know the attribute of weight. But nevertheless, weight is an attribute of table, and the concept table stands for that. And when you later discover the fact of weight, you realize that is part of what's designated by the concept. So it is included in the concept from the outset, in the form of the standing order that when you discover it, it's treated like every other attribute. So in that sense, the concept designates all the characteristics. It designates, to be exact, the existent, the table, including all its characteristics, whether known or not, whether definitional or not. And this idea of dividing analytic synthetic from synthetic statements according to whether the definition of the subject is or isn't already restated in the predicate is an example of a floating abstraction detached from reality, word construct as an end in itself without any connection to the perceptual level. And of course, the people that talk this way admit it. They distinguish between what they call a logical and empirical truths. The one type is supposed to be got just by linguistic manipulation, has nothing to do with percepts, and the other type you get from experience, but you never can know it, because How do you know? They've thrown out their method of knowledge as being just a means of manipulating language. Objectivism rejects that root and branch. And the reason underlying it is, what is a word? A word is a symbol for a concept. What is a concept? An integration of percepts. What is a percept? The perceptual level is the given. That. And therefore, as soon as you say sentence or proposition, you're saying concept, which means percept, which means that. You cannot break that chain and start analyzing sentences in a void. And that actually takes care of all of philosophy for centuries. This observation alone would wipe it all out. But what you have to see is that it goes back to the nature of concept formation. If you happen to know on your own anything about the state of philosophy, you will have a further appreciation of the Ayn Rand's theory of concepts, because that theory would make it impossible for the whole modern development. Kant wouldn't even be able to dream of his critique if he accepted one-tenth of Ayn Rand's viewpoint. On concepts alone, even if he rejected reality, which, of course, if he did that, he wouldn't hear her, but I'm trying to stress and bend over backwards to say specifically the theory of concepts is what wipes out all this corruption. Now, the last thing I want to point out to you on definitions, on this sequence, is to clarify this point on 155, right under the long quote from Ms. Rand. A concept once formed does not change. And here you have to distinguish concept, knowledge, definition. Those are not the same thing. Your knowledge changes in the sense that you can get more of it. Well, conceivably your brain could be damaged and you could lose some of it. So your knowledge can grow. Your definition may change accordingly. In a wider context, you may need to alter the characteristics that will perform this condensing and differentiating function. So those are alterable. But the thing that does not change is the unit, the mental integration that stands for those objects. That is immutable once you have it. And in that one respect, if Ayn Rand will forgive me, Plato was right when he said that an essential attribute of his universal forms is that they were motionless and immutable. They never changed, they were eternal. Now, of course, he put that in a supernatural, mystical context that we don't accept. But it is certainly true that concretes vary. You know, a given table comes into existence, does its job, corrodes, erodes, is chopped up, and is gone. But the concept table, as long as there are people around who have it at all, is the same. It doesn't alter as we learn more about tables or as we even redefine them. It, and this is the analogy that Ayn Rand used, which I think is very instructive, it is like the file folder in which we put everything about tables. So it's the same file folder that a child has, that an adult, that a furniture maker, that a scientist has. It's the exact same file folder. What differs is how much is in that folder and what label we put on it. I added that wrinkle to her metaphor, the label being the definition. But it's her metaphor. The label tells us at a quick glance what's in the folder. Oh, it's everything pertaining to rational animal. Okay, now I know, so I can cross-classify. Whatever I can check under animal, or check rationality is form of consciousness, so anything I want to know, I can check another file folder. But the key point is the folder is immutable. The only way you can get rid of or alter the folder is to discard it. That is, you can decide this was not the correct way of organizing information to begin with. That's what we call a conceptual reclassification. So you throw out certain classification as being based on an error and start over. There's been many such cases in the early attempts to give a scientific explanation of things. The Greeks, for instance, had a classificatory system of four types of temperament. you know, what is it, black bile and I can't remember, melancholia. There were four different, who remembers, types of temperament on the basis of different humors, different parts, and of course it had no actual basis. Well, we've dropped that to the point where I can't remember. Now that is dead, except for, you know, a historical interest. We don't think in those terms anymore, but that is not a case of a concept changing. It's just a case of a reclassification. You threw out that file folder. It was a mistake. There's nothing really should go in there, or whatever went in there should go in another one to keep the line straight. But it's apart from that type of case. Concept is immutable. It's the unit pointing to the thing out there, and the rest is just putting information in the file folder. Now, one last clarification. I don't want you to think that every definition of every term, no matter what, is always subject to alteration as the context of knowledge expands. Because obviously it's not true. There are many specialized cases. I don't have for you a formula that will cover it, but I'll tell you this much. There are a great many cases where the existent being defined is so demarcated and delimited at the outset that there is no way to learn anything more about it in the future that would require a change of definition. This is characteristically true of mathematical terms, for instance, like triangle, number series, etc., where we've already dealing on a tremendously high level of abstraction and have stripped away so many aspects that what's left, once you give a definition, will hold no matter how far on you go. And in a certain way, that's true of the definition of sensations. You can learn a great deal about red, but its causes and light waves and all that, but it still comes down to what you mean by red, what you point to. So isolated things or aspects, actions, etc., that are rigidly demarcated, I don't see that they necessarily would allow for contextual alteration. The real case where this comes to be is natural entities, like man, various living things, physical processes, etc., where we learn about a complex entity, and we learn in gradual stages, and there's always an abundance more that we don't know. It's in that type of setting that the alteration of definitions with time becomes essential. But don't misapply this to take any word at random and say, I can't imagine how you would redefine that 1,000 years from now. Now, I don't want to dogmatize. I can't imagine what I don't know. So if you could give me a word and say, can you imagine a situation thousands and millions of years from now in which something, I don't know what, would be discovered that wouldn't invalidate it, our present definition, but another one would be superior. The fact that I can't imagine it doesn't mean it isn't possible, nor does the fact that you can project it mean it is possible. Therefore, the best answer to that is we can't discuss it. You have no basis on which to hypothesize it, and I have none on which to reject it. Therefore, why it shouldn't come up. And that will be my answer to all those questions of, could you define a context in which the would need a new definition? No. I can't do it. Now, if you think that is a weakness, I confess it. I guess we'll take our 5-minute break here, and then we'll start with some questions on definition. I'll take a few minutes of questions on the section on definitions before we go to the crow. Yes.
Yes, there's a particular passage on page 144 where it says, the essential characteristic, the fundamental characteristic, which makes the unit the kind of existence that they are,
right,
and differentiates them from all other existence.
Right.
Now,
the definition of essential on page 144, yes.
Based on that definition, it would seem to me that if an entity did not have the essential characteristic, it would not be able to be represented by the concept. But I've heard you make remarks to the contrary before. And I don't see how it's, I think it would be more useful if it were restricted in this sense that this statement implies to me, because then...
Restricted to what?
Restricted, the concept would be restricted to representing things that only have the essential feature. In other words, if they didn't have the essential feature...
I'm sorry. I have to cut you off because you want to rewrite reality, and I can't entertain that, I'm sorry, as a possibility. Concepts, what they refer to, are not up to us. They are a form of integration. And to try to restrict a concept to certain attributes as against other is to vitiate the entire nature of concept formation. To ask that question, with all due respect, you have to have ignored the totality of introduction to objectivist epistemology, or perhaps, let's say, misinterpreted. And that is not something I can deal with in a general audience. I've covered that as thoroughly as I can. I have other questions on definition. Yes, at the back.
On page 153 in the middle, the state that there are concept refers to a designation so far is to be a perfectly clear description of the objectivist notion of meaning. But I was surprised not to see that word meaning used.
Why don't I use the word meaning? I don't use the word meaning because I would stand on my head to avoid being related to any semantic or linguistic tradition within the history of philosophy. Meaning is not a central philosophic concept. It belongs to semantics. It belongs to the study of communication. It has nothing to do with philosophy as a concept. This incredible emphasis on meaning, the meaning of meaning. When is a statement meaningful? Is the meaning of the subject in the predicate, etc.? All of that comes from the approach which severs concepts from percepts to begin with, and then has the problem of how the hell do you give them any meaning since they don't stand for what's out there. But if they do stand for what's out there, you don't need to make a big fuss about such a thing. And meaning is just a specialized study for a specialized science. So I go out of my way not to. I wouldn't concede to these people that it's worth a parenthesis, let alone, now in my younger days, I did the analytic synthetic and I mentioned it there. I even went into intention and extension and all that. I wouldn't do that anymore. That's okay when you're, before 40. Something on definitions, one more. Okay. Yes.
A foil by its commensurable yet radical difference from other existence having a lesser degree of difference swamps those lesser differences. Is this analogous to the role of essence in a definition?
I didn't get the first part. A what?
A foil.
What's a foil?
In Harry Binswanger's lectures, Consciousness as Identification. He speaks of a foil.
I don't know what a foil is. The only sense I can think of is foil as a foil in a drama. You mean that? Silver foil?
If you have two things that are somewhat far apart, for example, schematics.
Excuse me, can I just interrupt you? I think I know what you're after, and at most it's an analogy, so let me pass on it because I don't know the details of it. I'm sure that you mean something that's relevant, but I don't want to take the time to have to learn the whole vocabulary. Let us then go on to the Crow epistemology, the last sequence, concepts as devices to achieve unit economy. Now, of course, unit economy is condensation. It's being able to contain more and more information in smaller and smaller space. And therefore, we state now, having looked back and observed that concepts do this, we're making the inductive overview. This is what, in all the different instances, what we've done is compress a tremendous number of units into one. And therefore, properly, this comes at the end, for exactly the same reason as a consciousness possessing identity comes after the observation of sensation and perception. And here again, in the old days, when I was more rationalistic, I would start the discussion of concept formation with this principle, the need for unit economy, and then try to deduce if there's going to be unit economy, then there must be, etc., etc. And it was very aberrated because I was trying to extract reality from an axiom in the rationalistic fashion. And it's much better simply, Ayn Rand's advice was, if you want to discuss concept formation, look at concepts. See what actually happens. And then you can state broad generalizations, broad principles covering the whole process. As against, try to start with something that seems self-evident and deduce what reality has to be. Because reality has, many ways, many things about it that we don't know that we cannot deduce from axioms. Axioms are the precondition, but they're not that from which everything follows. Life or philosophy is not mathematics. So that's why this is the conclusion, even though it is as crucial to concept formation as consciousness having identity is to the whole of epistemology. Of course, it starts with the Crow experiment, and I got an urgent question submitted me twice today. The same computer reproduced twice and left off at different stopping points so that I would be sure and get it, and it's right on the Crow example. And he says, excerpting from this, the crow is an excellent metaphor. It could be used to swing a waverer fully into objectivism, but neither you nor Miss Rand cite the exact experiment. This leads to the problem of citing an anecdote as evidence. Is the crow experiment known, and if not, shouldn't we produce a formal scientific proof? And he even goes on, I'm not going to read all of this, but do you agree that scientifically proven demonstrable facts can and should be used to give philosophy metaphysical feet on the ground, even if only for illustrative purposes? Well, yes, I definitely agree. If you restrict it to only for illustrative purposes, absolutely. Because without illustration, it would be contentless. It would be a floating abstraction. But the point is, that's what the Crow is for. The Crow was an illustration. It was not the proof of the principle of unit economy. It was simply a graphic demonstration on another species, or rather example, on another species of something that we perceive on our own. If you don't like the Crow example, you think, because I never did find out in what journal it was reported. And I don't know now how I could ever. I mean, I just can't call a Brooklyn Public Library and say, Crow, give me some information, which is what I usually do when I don't know. But if you don't like that example, or you feel maybe the crows didn't behave this way, you can forget about crows, since it's only an example. It's not a metaphor, by the way, according to this questioner. It is a literal example of the fact that consciousness can only retain so many units in the focus of its attention at any given time. And if you want a different example, just look at the bottom of 157, or more to be exact, look at 160. Paragraph 4, the big paragraph. You see there's a line that has a bunch of slashes and then two sets of them below. Now I defy you looking at these to hold the distinction between these three. You cannot do it because I deliberately put enough slashes in to be beyond your ability to grasp. Therefore you couldn't differentiate. All you can see, but don't count now. Somebody is cheating because I see your lips moving. That's using concepts. If you just perceive, you cannot distinguish those three. Now, the better example in the bottom of 157, it just becomes a blur or a spread. You can't keep that many separated and focused on at the same time. You can quickly oscillate among three, four, five, and keep them before you, but not when it gets to that quantity. Another example, if you don't like it, I give in the book is from the Critique of Pure Reason. Try and hold any one sentence in which you are so overloaded with units that you simply physically cannot hold the subject by the time you get to the predicate. You first have to do a special process of automatizing the subject, which takes a long time, and then you try to connect whatever you could glean of the subject to whatever you can glean of the predicate, and you make a whole statement out of it, and then you try to connect it to the earlier statement. That's the only way you can read it. All of those are examples of which the crow is a simple example. The principle, of course, that the crow epistemology illustrates is the law of identity in another form applied to consciousness. This is the law of identity from the aspect of its quantitative restrictions on existence. And one implication of identity, of being something, is that the quantity must be something. Everything is limited. It's limited quantitatively in the number of its attributes and in the range or extent of any given attribute. That is another aspect of being something. The antonym identity in this case is the unlimited or the infinite, the literal infinite. That is the infinite or the unlimited is another way of being nothing in particular. Not this quantity is against some other. And therefore, inherent in the law of identity is every existent is limited in every respect. And that applies to consciousness. Consciousness is a faculty, we can describe it as perceiving units, but then it can only perceive so many at a given time. So if you want, you could take that as a deductive argument, but it would be ridiculous to do it that way because it doesn't need argumentation. Nothing is clearer than the fact that we can only hold so many units at a given moment. And if you try, every one of us has had the experience where your mind is overloaded and it just tunes out. You can't take the information in. And I wouldn't be so cruel, but I could create it for you right now by giving you a list of 13 esoteric objections that I want you to keep in mind before your mind, before I answer any one. And you'll go back and forth. You can hold one and then another. And at a certain point, you simply can't do it. I mean, without writing, mind you. You just have to memorize the sounds. Even 13 isolated words, you'd have your work cut out to keep them all before you. So this is not something that requires demonstration. This is a perceivable fact. But the crow is an eloquent example of it. And the principle is stated on the bottom of 157, consciousness is finite. There's only a limited number of units that can be discriminated from one another and held in the focus of awareness at a given time. Of course, in an undiscriminated way, I could just rove over thousands of objects, but they're not one distinct from the other, held in the forefront of my consciousness. They're just a blur, a spread. Now, this is, of course, Ayn Rand's identification of what is the crucial function of concepts. They enable us to take this massive amount of perceptual information, which we simply could not hold. We couldn't be aware of in its relations to each other if we didn't somehow condense it to the number of units that we can take in. And that's what concepts are. They're devices to reduce the information contained in percepts to the size of number of units that you can hold in the forefront of your awareness. And I think a good way of putting this point on the bottom of 158, if you know that last full paragraph, if you know the stock formula among philosophers, they say concepts are time savers. You know, if you had enough time, they said if you had an infinite life, this is the standard viewpoint. You never use the word man. You could just, before you said man, for instance, has 10 fingers, you could just recite the name of everybody. Tom, Dick, Harry, Mr. A, Mr. B. You said you would have an infinite time, so suppose it took you 1,000 years. They don't care. I mean, they're just philosophers. So they say really the only function of concepts is to save us time. Instead of giving a name, you know, imagine giving a name to every bit of sand. And instead of calling them sand, you say this is Joe and Harry and Sally. But they say, well, it's just a practical inconvenience. The actual fact is that they are not time savers. They are that, but that's not the essence. And this is my formulation, which I think is very helpful. They are space savers. Mental space savers. And then I develop in the next paragraph, even if you had infinite time, you would be no further ahead by the modern idea. of just giving a proper name to everything and having millions of years to do it. The problem is not that we don't have enough time to survey or enumerate trillions and trillions of concretes. The problem is even if we completed such a survey, we were immortal and had a spaceship that would take us to everyone past, present, and future, we wouldn't be able to hold it together in our mind. By the time we got to the next century's units, we would long have forgotten these. We couldn't hold that wealth. It just keep evaporating away, and you would never get to the content of the thought, man has. You couldn't get have, you couldn't get ten, you couldn't get finger. All you would get is fleeting perceptual groups supplanted by other perceptual groups, and which would go on to infinity. And now if that creature could say what the problem was, as I say in that last paragraph of 159, he'd say, if only I could squeeze into one frame of awareness all of these units. But the trouble is he can't. And of course that means if he could integrate all of these percepts into one entity, one mental entity. And that's exactly what a concept does. Now, here is my best epigram, or what do you call it? In the entire book on the bottom of 159, the one I like best. That Ayn Rand's epistemology is a switch on a picture is worth a thousand words. Her viewpoint is a word is worth a thousand pictures. Now, that's pretty clever if I say so myself. But you see, thank you. There is truth in the statement that a picture is worth a thousand words. And when, in what context is that statement applicable? If your concern is to grasp a concrete in all its concreteness, to know what a given man, for instance, looks like, then it's much better to go to the perceptual level, because the perceptual level will give you the uniqueness at a glance. Whereas if I have to describe what makes Greta Garbo's face distinctive from every other, I might write pages and pages of anatomy and psychology and perspective and so on, and it would still be extraordinarily difficult to project without an image. When your concern is to grasp a concrete in its uniqueness, the standard slogan is true. But what is so brilliant about Ayn Rand's theory is a picture is comparatively low level. A word precisely takes a thousand, in fact, an unlimited number of pictures. And all the information they contain lets you hold all of them in your mind in one unit. So I wanted to point out, if your goal is to expand the scale of your consciousness, then you got to give the nod to word over pictures. Of course, the word is meaningless unless it's the end of a concept formation, which goes back to percepts. So you can't really have a war between pictures and words, but from the aspect that we're talking about here. And notice when we're talking about expanding consciousness, wouldn't you know that they would call LSD and its equivalent mind expanding? That is the big lie, if ever I heard it, because it's the literal opposite. It shrinks and contracts the mind. They regard abstraction as the enemy of consciousness, and you have to kill the conceptual faculty in order to expand the mind. And thus the idea of drugs, and attune you to a mystic dimension. But the literal truth is that the way to expand your mind is to increase the amount of data that you can get onto the screen. And that is by the abstraction method, by conceptualization. So it's exactly reason which is mind expanding or consciousness expanding, so that this slogan of the drug culture is truly the big lie, the absolute reverse of the truth. Now, on page 161, this will be my last remark that I want to call to your attention. I just want to indicate to you all, or at least many of the different ways in which this concept of condensation runs throughout the objectivist philosophy. I mentioned it to begin with under sensation. I said, in Ayn Rand's view, sensation sums up or condenses a vast number of physical facts in the form of a single sensation. But now, if we ascend the scale of consciousness, you will see continuously the compression of content to make room for a broader perspective, and then the compression, etc. Now, here's the change, so to speak, or at least some highlights of it. The primary sensations themselves amount to automatic condensations of a vast complexity of physical data. The next stage is we get a wealth of sensations which we distinguish and integrate into a percept. And that percept is now a form of unit economy. Although it's automatic, we don't do it for that reason. But all of the sensations pertaining to a table, touch, weight, etc., and so on, that we discussed this under the passage from sensation to perception, are contained in an aspect of this one integrated unity, the percept of table. So everything that we experience successively as a whole bunch of separate sensations is now condensed into one experience, one percept. Now when we go to the conceptual level, we're taking percepts, which themselves you see are condensations, and supercondensing. We're taking it, and by a volitional means now, it's not given to us automatically, we're taking these percepts within a given category, like table or whatever it is, and putting an endless number together into one unit by the word. Throughout, we're condensing condensations and then condensing again in order to expand our range by keeping the same information in fewer units. Higher level concepts do exactly the same thing to lower level concepts. When you can think in terms of furniture and traffic, you keep in those two units a whole amount of stuff that you had previously conceptualized separately. So now you can hold table, chair, sofa, truck, bus, etc., and so on in just two units, furniture, traffic. And the more abstract you go, you can cover the entire universe, like causality, necessity, and so on. In that sense, the higher up the hierarchy, what we're doing is going to broader and broader integrations, more and more unit reduction. So the whole nature of consciousness, and this is Ayn Rand's really crucial discovery, is an ascending scale of compressing content so that we can grasp it in one frame of awareness. When a species can't do that, then it's restricted to the animal or even sub-animal level. And concepts in that respect, although they differ in many ways from other things, are a continuation of what we see throughout the realm of consciousness. Condensation in that way is of the essence of the development of consciousness. That's the most fundamental way to describe what does the development of consciousness from its lowest to its highest form, what is the difference? And the answer in a word is range or scope. And that means how much, it's a quantitative issue. Consciousness is from, here again, measurement omission. Consciousness is from the lowest ant, or what is it, Harry? That thing that has only sensations. But from the lowest jellyfish, that's it. From the lowest jellyfish to the highest man, the difference in the consciousness is a difference in measurement. And specifically, how much can it hold in the forefront of its awareness? How much can it integrate? How many units can it reduce to a unit? You see, so from that point of view, the conceptual level is a continuation of the whole development of consciousness. Now, I find that extremely illuminating as a kind of fundamental approach to the whole field of consciousness, and to make concepts something that didn't just somehow spring out of the blue, that are part of the whole development within nature. Now, if you want me really to cash in fully on this, I would have to give you chapter 12. That's on art, but you don't have that here, but the principle really gets carried home fully when we get to what is the function of art. And you know, it's to enable you to hold your philosophy, actually experience the reality of your philosophy, your view of life, your view of the universe, to concretize and make it real. That is an example of the very same principle. Philosophy is a series of broad abstractions. The universe is this way or that way, other people are this way or that way, which would be floating. You wouldn't have the full sense of their reality. And if you tried to chew each one and explain, oh, I mean this, and I mean this, and I mean this, and metaphysics is such a broad subject, you can focus as a philosopher on any given one element of it. But you couldn't get the total, the view of life that way, because what? Too many units. By the time you went through existence, and consciousness, and identity, and causality, and the primacy of existence, and all the rest that's required to give you a view of existence, you would lose, well, what is it like as a total to experience reality that way? And that is exactly what art does. Art reduces philosophy to a unit, to a concrete which carries the total of philosophy. So art in that sense, an artwork is to a philosophy what a word is to a concept. It's the concrete which stands for all the other units that you can't put together. Or rather, what a concept is to its instances. There's too many units, and therefore you have to condense them to one. And the same is true of philosophy. Too many units to hold as a total. And their art gives it to you as a single unit, as a single concrete. If you read about John Galt and Projective, that gives you your experience of the world, or an experience of the world, whether it's yours or not, a view of the world, in one frame of awareness. You just say Galt, and if that's real to you, that percept, that projection of how he would speak, what he would say, how he would sound, how he would act, all of which is contained in the image of the projection, carries with it and condenses into one percept the total of philosophy. And from that point of view, that is really Ayn Rand's theory of art. It's a continuation of the crucial role of condensation in human consciousness. All right, let's take a few questions now on the crow, and then I'm going to set aside for the special question. Yes?
I'm interested in the relation of condensation to measurement omission. I mean, when you ask the question in a way that relates to an earlier section, if all measurements of reference are omitted in the concept.
Say it again.
If all measurements of reference are omitted in the concept. Actually, page
26. Page 6?
126.
Oh, 126.
Page 126. bottom of the first paragraph. Four lines from the bottom.
Omit all the measurements of those characteristics. That is that what you mean? Is that the sentence?
The sentence says it retains all the characteristics of its reference and to omit all the measurements.
Perhaps what's bothering you there is that there are concepts which are subdivisions of broader concepts in which you deliberately hold certain measurements fixed. Which way?
Higher level concepts, broader.
Well, what would be an example?
Well, let me finish the question. My question is, what gives rise to the economy of higher level concepts if you've already squeezed the measurements out?
What gives rise to that?
The dimensions of measurements.
There's a new angle of perspective. Well, you have to, in answer to that question, read really Ayn Rand's chapter on higher level concepts, because it's a broader angle of perspective. From the perspective of forming the concept table, you are distinguishing tables from chairs, from beds. Within that framework, you omit the things that are required to set this entity apart from that, the shape of the surface, the number of supports, etc. When you go to furniture, You are omitting the measurements of all the specifics that set apart beds from tables from couches. Each one of those is, from the point of view of furniture, the way Ayn Rand put it, is regarded as a category of measurements within the broad concept furniture. And you say furniture represents, what is her definition? Something large objects fixed within a human habitation for certain purposes. Now that includes many subcategories. If we specify that and say, well, the object has to be approximately in this shape, it comes as a bed, and in this category of shape, it comes as a couch, etc. But we're omitting greater measurements from the aspect of furniture than we were omitting from the point of view of table. So it depends from what angle you are looking at. But now, absolutely speaking, just to cover this point, I hope this is not misunderstood when we say we omit all measurements. There are many concepts that include a numerical measurement right in the concept. And in fact, this is discussed in the book. One of these professors picked a specific type of tire. What is it, 715 something tire? And he wanted to know how could that be reached by measurement omission, since there's a measurement right in it. And of course, her answer was, so far as you have an abstraction, it omits measurement. But there's nothing to say you can't subdivide it, hold one dimension fixed. Well, then the thing is concrete to that extent. It does not vary from instance to instance. That one thing is held the same. Therefore, you perform your measurement omission only in regard to the parts that are not fixed. And that's very common in concept formation, to include a specific quantitative. It's usually in the form of a subcategory. But I would refer you there to her chapter on concept formation, because I think she explicitly discusses in what sense you can regard the aspects of a table, which are characteristics in regard to concept formation, as categories of measurement in relation to furniture. She discusses that actually there. So I think that's a little beyond us. It's not good to do those things extemporaneously, because it gets so technical, it's more misleading than she labored very carefully to, because she wanted to allay the idea that, well, you can call anything a measurement that you want. You really have to be able to show that it's commensurable, you see. But the whole thing with higher level concepts is that they couldn't be gotten directly from table and chair. Only through the earlier concept. That's the key to it. But I think that should help you. Now let's give the quiet people a chance here. Now we're going to open the question for a while to people who have never asked a question in this entire course. And you can ask me anything. That is to say, about the first three chapters. Yes.
Is there anything else you can say about the universe as a whole other than the fact that it exists? Like, I'm thinking particularly of the question, is the universe finite or infinite or something like that? Or does it even make sense to ask that question?
Good question. Is there anything else you can say about the universe as a whole besides the fact that it exists? Can you, for instance, say that the universe is finite or infinite, or does that even make sense to ask? I would say the answer is the only thing that a philosopher can say about the universe as a whole is it is. That's it. Plus whatever that entails, whatever is implicit in or logically unavoidable given that it is. That's it. Now what is inherent in that? It is something. The universe is something. It is governed by law, that is, whatever its elements or features or aspects are, they act according to their nature. It is what it is. It is finite. If by finite you mean simply limited, that is, the law of identity applied to the quantity. Definitely, objectivism believes the universe is finite. It is not infinite. Simply on the grounds of the law of identity. That's all. Now, we don't have a view of the shape of the universe. Well, I've heard that discussed, but that is not a part of objectivism. It's a question whether the universe has a shape, whether the term is applicable. Certainly, the universe does not have temporal duration. You couldn't say, how long has the universe been here? You know, the New York Times discovers a new birthday of the universe periodically in their science section on Tuesdays. The universe did not have a birthday and start Big Bang and so on. That is all nonsense. The universe is eternal, out of time altogether. Time is in the universe, not the other way around. Time is a frame of reference, of measurement, of motion within some part of the universe. For instance, we use the motions of the Earth and so on around the sun to establish time. But that's a one little fragment within the universe. But if you step outside the total, it's utterly without content. It's meaningless to say, how long has it existed? What do you mean? How many revolutions of what? There's nothing else to measure it in relation to. The same is true of where is the universe? The universe is nowhere. Where's are in the universe? Can you say the universe is in Chicago? I mean, this would be absurd. Or in the north. I mean, the north of what? There's dimensions, directions, position, are relationships established between one part of the universe and another. They become empty when applied to the totality. It's just exactly like, what movie is the universe watching now? I mean, if it's the universe, there is nothing else. There's nothing outside it to watch. And nor can you ask, if you stood outside the universe, what would it look like? I mean, what shape would it have? Because the phrase outside the universe is meaningless. That means something apart from anything. And that is out of the question. Now, I happen to think there's a few other little things that you could dredge up about the universe as a whole, but I'm here in my capacity as official spokesman for Ayn Rand, so I'm keeping any such thoughts to myself. But if you're interested, you could look up Parmenides in ancient Greece. I think he had some wise things to say, but it really more pertains to physics than philosophy. Okay, that's a good survey of chapter one. Now, this is still for people who never asked. Yes. Do I think it would be possible to teach concept formation to a computer? I don't know enough about computers. They know how to play chess. Well, I don't know enough about computers to know how complex a program you can give them. The key would, now, of course, even if they learned, it wouldn't have awareness. I don't believe in what they call artificial intelligence as a form of consciousness. The computer is an inanimate object. It knows nothing. It just prints out, you know, these black dots on the screen. So it's a mistake to call it intelligence, but assuming you're using that for short and you're using the equivalent for short, you would have to give it a program beyond anything I can imagine. I don't know how you would get the open-ended character into it. You see, what you could do, as far as I can, I don't know enough about computer programming or what's, I don't want to, you know, arbitrarily delimit because they can do fantastic things. If you could somehow feed it perceptual data, encode that, and the method of distinguishing some kinds of data from other kinds of data, and the method of coming up with a new symbol which would carry along all the other symbols, but in such a way that without doing any more, it could use that to subsume data not yet present to it. You see, and the problem would be, how would the computer know that the endless men of which you, the programmer, knows nothing are already in it? You see. Now, I don't know how that could be done. And so I don't know that you could even simulate the surface of concept formation through a computer. All I would say is, assuming somebody did it, what he would have to do is break down what the human mind does and digest all the steps, and then it would be just cranked out automatically. I doubt that you could do anything more than, you know, the most simplistic semi-suggestion of it, because the whole nature of the thing is the open-ended, unlimited scale of being able to refer to what you don't know. And I don't know how you would program that into a machine. I truly have no idea. I know they have machines that can talk, But they, you know, they talk and hold conversation in an entirely different way than forming concepts. They just manipulate words according to programs, you know. And if you press them one sentence beyond what they're programmed for, they just say no response, you know. Ask again, you know. They program like certain interviewers interview, you know. They just say, oh yes, and why do you say that? Oh yes, how interesting. You know, well, I mean, that is not a conversation. Now, we're still restricting this to people who have not asked before. You haven't? Okay, go ahead.
A particular banana is a unit of the concept banana. And the concept banana is a unit of the concept fruit. Now, is a particular banana a unit of the concept fruit? Can you jump?
Absolutely. The unit of a concept, the thing it integrates, is the concretes in reality. A concept does not refer to other concepts. Fruit is not a way. If I say there's fruit in the room, I had to first, let us say, conceptualize peach, pear, plum, banana, and let us assume that. And then we got fruit. But once I've got fruit, fruit is not a way of saying peach, pear, plum, banana. Fruit is a broad category, and I'm referring to all pieces of fruit, which are the units of the concept fruit. The point of it being a higher level concept is that you couldn't get there until you first conceptualized the first level instances. But still, the units, the actual units means the things in reality that are being integrated. Now, you could say that you integrate concepts. You know, there is a perspective in which you could say you have to put together chair, table, and so on to make furniture. But when I talk about the furniture in this room, I'm talking about something out there. I am not talking about the concepts in my mind by which I reach the reference to furniture. I'm talking about the objects, you see. And therefore, furniture stands for all objects of furniture. Those are the units. Even though they couldn't be referred to that way, unless you had first conceptualized the parts. Do you get that? Now, this is still for people who have never asked a question. At the very back, yes, I'm glad you, I know you've tried many times and I somehow never got to. Yeah.
You say that the choice to focus must precede any idea. But it occurs to me that one would need to have at least the idea of life itself as a value before choosing to be in focus. Because otherwise it would be automatic, like respiration or
digestion. Like what?
Like respiration.
Well, let me answer this. The question is, I'm glad you asked this. I say that the choice to focus has to precede any idea, because that's the act that brings you into commission as a conscious being. And you're asking if I can amend your question in a form that I agree with. Don't you need in some form the awareness or the grasp that it's worth, that it's important, that it's desirable to be aware? Otherwise, why would you do it? If you put it that way, this was asked to me by many people after free will discussions raged for a long time after that class, and many of them ended up asking me this question, so I'm glad you asked it. I do think, and this doesn't contradict what I said, that if you could imagine a consciousness that reached the conceptual level without having grasped ever, in any way, the value of awareness, if I projected that possibility, then there would be no reason for it to focus. But the construct is impossible, because the value of awareness, not now of focus as such, but of awareness, is self-evident to any conscious species. It doesn't have the term value, of course, but the need of awareness to anything it does is unavoidable. No species can have a faculty of awareness and have a moment's doubt about the necessity of this faculty. It doesn't have the words for that. But from the moment that it attempts to initiate action, so long as it's simply passive, it may not see any distinction in significance between being awake and being asleep. And nothing makes any difference. The moment it starts to function, and we're speaking here of animals who don't have choice, let alone human, and you know, children, let alone human adults. The moment it starts to function, it is inescapable, the need to be aware. The dog knows it can't close its eyes and cross the street or go to dinner. It can't stop sniffing and say to hell with it. Even though it's automatic, it's grasped, obviously, inescapably. And the proof of that is there's no way, if somebody said to you, prove to me that consciousness is essential to my function. There is no such proof as that. Because what is the proof? Walk across the street with your eyes closed. That's it. Have a perceptual experience. This is a perceptual datum. If you need to discover that, that means you've never been aware. Because once you've been aware, the necessity of being aware is inescapable. Now, if you call that an idea, then you need that idea. But I don't call that an idea because I think it's a perceptual datum. But if you want to say, well, that really is the motive for consciousness, I mean, I think it's a confusing way to put it. But then I would say, if you're going to call that the motive, you have to make a distinction between the motive of any motive and a motive. The choice to focus, if you're going to call that a motive, is the choice to enter the realm of motivation. That which is required to pursue any motive. And in that sense, I don't think it's helpful to say that was my motive. But if you want to say, well, yes, you really had to grasp awareness, you grasp that from the beginning. And if you want, then you can distinguish a metaphysical motive from a specific motive. And the metaphysical motive of focus would be, it's a precondition of anything. It precedes having a motive. It gets you into the world of having motives. And it's that point that I was trying to stress by saying it is not motivated. I was trying to cover the idea, you don't come into focus in order to do any particular thing or study any particular subject, but in order to be here. You see, but that doesn't preclude that you had to grasp at some point that being here in that conscious sense is important. But you grasp that far before the issue of choice or concepts reach you. I hope that will lay motivation to rest. Well, I want to compliment the people who have been, I'm sorry we're out of time, but every one of you people that have been silent all the time, that's a very good question. So I would like to encourage you to wave your hands more vigorously and not, be intimidated. Thank you very much, and we will continue next time.